How's everybody? Tests tomorrow, I understand, huh? I hope I'm not taking you all away from studying, or maybe just a little bit.
Welcome. We're very pleased and honored to have Jimmy Smits with us today. I think this is, your third or fourth visit back? Jimmy, as you probably know, has had a terrific career in theater, television, film, several iconic television shows like L.A. Law and NYPD Blue, most recently Dexter. He's appeared at the Public Theater. He's appeared on Broadway. He's won an Obie Award and a Golden Globe. I'm not an Obie, an Emmy and a Golden Globe.
I'd rather have the Obie, though.
we can make that happen. And he's also been involved with foundation work that raises money for Latino students to go to school and to have connections to the industry. He's involved with the TDF, Theater Development Fund, City University of New York program called BEAT, which is interested in getting students who haven't had much experience in theater or of the theater at CUNY involved in various programs that TDF offers. And he is the Artist of the Year Award winner here at Cornell this year. So please welcome again Jimmy Smits. So I thought we'd just start with a few questions. What attracted you to the theater and to performing when you were growing up in Brooklyn?
When I was growing up in Brooklyn? Well, because of family dynamics, we tended to move around a lot. So I basically lived all over five boroughs of New York City and spent a fair amount of time in Puerto Rico, where my mother's from, also 2 or 3 years. I went to school there between 10 and 12. So this is after, I'm telling you this because after therapy, we've kind of designated where the acting bug might have come from. And because there was a lot of moving around and very vastly different economic areas and areas that had different ethnic concentrations, depending on how much money the parents had at that particular time, it forced me, I think, to kind of constantly trying to find ways to fit into different situations, social mm-hmm. situations. Most of the time, not very well, but and because subsequently because of that, there was a lot of loneliness involved in that also. But I think that's where the kind of seeds were planted, and in my fourth grade class, there was a teacher that did a play, and in junior high school, there was always somebody. The plays were always. The theater was involved in my life in some way. In junior high school, I went to a junior high school in Brooklyn called George Gershwin Junior High School, and because of the name, there was kind of a music and arts legacy, and there was a music teacher there that the big thing was to be in the school play at the end of the year, and because it was George Gershwin, she would do these. What seemed to me, I think they were pretty lavish productions, and everybody really wanted to get into these. And when I was an adult and she was retiring, I was in charge of getting her a plaque, and she had been through the Rodgers and Hammerstein canon mm-hmm. like twice. So, I mean, she dedicated her life to doing that. So I did a lot of plays in junior high school. In high school, had a drama teacher. I played sports in high school, but I kind of quit the football team to be in the drama club because you couldn't be in both at the same time. It was, I don't even want to get into that, but I had to give up my jacket and not be able to sit at the table with the team and all that, and I went with the drama guys. But there was a drama teacher there who was doing his graduate work at the time at Brooklyn College in theater, and he was teaching teaching drama and English in high school. And he did a number of productions, but what he also did was he took us to go see plays. So during the 1970s, I saw a lot of theater. I went to go see a lot of theater. That was his thing. It was, I mean, I know that it was gratifying something in him, but mm-hmm. he was sharing that with audiences. And that exposure to theater, to me, was just like, it was awesome to see the Royal Shakespeare Company or James Earl Jones and Christopher Plummer doing Othello in Stratford, Connecticut. There were just like pivotal moments that were kind of like, ding, wow. Seeing Sweeney Todd and hearing that bell go off. Theater's always been, it's just always been, you know, brewing in there. And then I went to, did my undergraduate work at City University at Brooklyn College, where that particular high school teacher was graduated from, and got to take advantage of everything there. There was a professor who was a working actor on a soap opera at the time and had done some work in films and theater. And it was he that kind of pushed me in the direction of the graduate work, you know, continuing my education. Mm-hmm. And the line that he said was, you probably could go to LA now and be the crook of the week on some on some show on Hill Street Blues or something like that. But you know, you've shown an interest in the classics, and I've done a number of Shakespearean plays, and I think you should do these auditions. And I got to, you know, do a number of auditions for different schools and did what at that time were called the ERTIS.
Yeah, still have.
Yeah, they still have the ERTIS, right? And because TCG has a whole set of auditions,
right?
Also, and one of the people that I got to meet was sitting here in this audience, Stephen Cole. And they asked if I would want to come up and go for the ride here at Cornell. And I got to tell you that, at that time there was a graduate program here. And it was a small, very small program, but it was basically like being in a monastery. but I mean that in the best sense of the word, because I was able to take advantage of, just be a sponge and take advantage of everything that the university had to offer in the way of the arts and the quality of the professors that they had coming in, people that were coming in from New York, and the guest writers and directors that had come in. So I really here got my tool bag full. So that interest that I had mm-hmm. in the classics and, you know, I was not really a good student in high school, but when that first year of college, when I was able to apply doing research to a role, it was like, oh, shit. You mean, I could stay in the library for hours, you know, trying to decipher why the buttons on the cuffs were the way they were in Elizabethan England, or going to the Brooklyn Public Library and listening to plays and on LP records. But all of that was very kind of raw when I left Brooklyn. And I think that what the biggest thing that I got here was I really kind of had a formulated technique. And you guys were really throwing so much at us. It was different because it wasn't like, oh, we're just going to do, we do Stanislavski here, or it was just different styles were coming at us. Everything from, you know, your traditional Stanislavski or Meisner to bioenergetics and the voice and diction stuff that we had to do. They had somebody from the American Mime Theater. Paul Curtis, who was here. And there was no pressure to, like, this is the way you have to roll. You were a sponge, and all of this stuff kind of, like, went through you, and basically, I got to fill my tool bag up with a way of approaching roles, a technique, a way to do research. And it was very helpful when I left here. Besides the fact that in the summers, we had the Hangar Theater, which was, I don't know if you guys know about the Hangar Theater, but I just came from there, and it's a very beautiful, the space that they redid the theater there. And I got to do a lot of plays there. So I was like always working on something, you know. Seemed like 24/7, 365. It was always something different, way different. So, I mean, I got to tackle, you know, Shakespeare and Shaw here, and Wiedekind and new plays. We had playwrights in residence that were Ronnie Tavel, who came here, was like the experimental type theater, and Cuckoo's Nest. I did a lot. I got to do a lot of stuff here, and got to appreciate what it is to be in an ensemble, because you weren't always the lead in a particular production. Mm-hmm. And I carry that with me. I think that's influenced the choices that I've made as an actor, and what success that I've had. I tend to function better in a kind of an ensemble atmosphere, and I think that this place was seminal in that. But again, it was, you know, I'll go back to the whole thing about, you know, having the tool bag. And when I left here, I remember Steve and Alison Van Dyke saying, there's so many things that you're not in control of with regards to the business, being in the right place, networking, luck. But what you have is a technique, and whether I get the chance to do it, I know that I can do it. I can tackle whatever it is, from Crook of the Week to, you know, a Shakespearean play. And and luckily, it gave me a kind of confidence so that when I went to New York, I got very lucky. I'm blessed in so many ways. But I think that what I got from here, that the tool bag that I had with me, came in very handy. And I had a confidence that I definitely didn't have, you know, after leaving Brooklyn, and which is not disparaging on them, but I had a technique. Mm-hmm. So I got to work. I got lucky, and I started working in, you know, little off-Broadway plays pretty soon after graduating, and that led to daytime work in television. And
you talked about when you went to...
No.
Damn, man, I just asked a little question like that. It just went off. Sorry.
You talked about when you first went to all those plays, you discovered that you had permission to act. Could you talk about that a little bit?
Did I mention James L. Jones?
Yes.
I think James L. Jones Raul Julia. I saw a lot of plays that Raul Julia did. Raul Julia's an actor who a lot of you guys might know from the Addams Family movies, but he did a lot of work in New York, and he was a fine actor. Saw stuff at the Puerto Rican Traveling Theater, and I mentioned James Earl Jones and Raul because they're very successful, notable actors who I later got to meet in a professional sense, and I got to actually tell them the impact that they had on me. But I think the fact that I was seeing something on stage that was like, in other words, Raul comes from Puerto Rico, has a Latin surname, Spanish was his first language, he had an accent, but that didn't stop him from doing everything as an actor. And I got to see him do Pinter and, Taming of the Shrew. I saw him do a lot of different things.
He did Lear with James Earl Jones.
He did Lear with James Earl Jones. I saw a production of Othello that Christopher Plummer and Mr. Jones did in Connecticut and Stratford. Stratford, yeah. Connecticut. And it was the first time that I saw a physical kind of naturalism that was infused with the language that was going on. And you would think that was counter, but it was beautifully, like, just melded. And another bell went off when I was able to see that. But the fact that I got to see them, and it kind of said, well, they come from the same kinds of neighborhoods that you come from, and they, the same parentage and all that stuff. It helped me to kind of reaffirm that this trajectory that I was on, I was seeing something that was mirroring something positive that gave me permission to continue, So in my mind, if I saw them do that, it's not impossible that I might be able to do that myself.
In your toolkit, what items have been the most valuable and enduring in your career?
An appreciation of language. And understanding that there's cyclical things that repeat themselves. And if you do enough research, you're able to find, if you understand the root of something, you can understand how Romeo and Juliet becomes West Side Story. And you can have an emotional connection and understand it on different levels. So that's been really very, very valuable to me.
And how did you adapt things from stage to the camera mediums?
To me, it's just like shifting gears in a car, because you're doing the same stuff in terms of the way you go about creating a role, but you have to have a different kind of an awareness as the actor when you're on stage in front of 150 people or, 500 people, because you're more in tune with the physical presence of the body in space and how that relates if a movement that you do can read to a person up there, that you can reflect a certain emotionality with a movement that could get you in trouble on a TV set, because you could be doing all of this, and if the camera's right in a shot like that, it doesn't make a difference what you're doing with your body. But the basics of what does the character want in this particular moment, what are the obstacles in that particular scene for the character? All is the same. It just gets internalized in a different way. So something that you might do on stage that might be physically demonstrative, you can, that you're thinking about while you're doing it, when you're in, you know, on a soundstage and you have a camera that's very tight on you, you're still going through all of that, but it's in a very kind of internalized way. And hopefully, well, not hopefully, but most of the time, the camera can pick that up. The camera can get in your eyes and see and feel those things. So much more important the things that are not said, but the inner dialogue that's going on with your character.
So you've had these wonderful roles on these major television shows, and you've done film work. How has that industry, particularly the one located on the West Coast, or we think about what located on the West Coast, how has it changed during the time of your first contact with it?
You're asking with regards to the business of it, or because that's a whole other animal, that's become a whole other animal, or?
I think
on a technical level.
I think both the technical level and the business level.
On the technical level, most television shows now are shot exclusively on video cameras, high def cameras. And that's only happened very recently. I was on the producing team of a particular television show a couple of years back, and I literally had to fight tooth and nail to try to get them to still use film, because the tendency now, it's just cheaper to do, and it involves less of lighting setups and stuff. So that dynamic, and you, on most, I would say 80% of all television is done on, all dramatic television, mm-hmm. or comedies are done now on high definition cameras. Most independent films are done on high def cameras, and then in the technical process of editing, there's a film kind of look that you have. So on the technical level, what happens is, first of all, they're very unforgiving in terms of the way that the look. you don't have that same. It's harder to get those kind of beauty shots, and the high def camera picks up every single pore in your body. And so what we used to be able to do with makeup and lighting, you as an actor have to take care of before you get on set. But that's just one of the great things is you don't have to, you can continually roll for what seems to be, you know, an eternity. And that in certain circumstances can be very, very, you know, freeing, because, you know, you can just redo scenes or do takes over and over again. And it's not that whole thing about waiting for a setup and readjusting the lights for different angles. And also the cameras have gotten very small. I worked on Star Wars, and when we shot in Australia, Lucas, being the technical savvy guy that he is, he kind of forced Panavision he was one of the first people to use this high def camera in a feature film. And it was at its infancy. But I remember walking into what they call Video Village, and he just had, Video Village is where you have the little monitors and you're looking at what Lucas has, Video Village is like this. It's like big, huge plasma screens, and he pushed stuff to the limits. So in that way, what you can do technically with these cameras now is just like an incredible thing. A lot of the work, you mentioned Dexter. Working in a car on a film was always a very, very involved process of getting a car, having a tow car and another car, and the way you do an angle, you had to have mounts on cars, and now the boys are just in the back with you. The camera, the red camera, is so small that they're, I mean, it's fascinating how, on a technical level, things have gotten.
It seems to be less intrusive of the actor's process in a way because
yeah,
you can't.
Yeah. But then, you know, every now and then there's something about the pristineness of an anamorphic lens. I might be getting too technical
with it.
But when you see a movie that you know is shot on film that has a kind of like, you know, mm-hmm. that. So there's a big debate about the usefulness of that. On the business side, how many of you guys are like theater majors here? Okay. Yeah, we're involved in the program. In the acting department or writing? Great.
How many film majors here? Any film majors?
Okay. Well, I guess because what you guys are going to, when you walk out these doors and because of technology and the internet and Facebook and Twitter and all that stuff, the business has become a totally different animal. And I don't think branding was, the concept of branding was something that we ever discussed. And you know, everybody chooses their own path in terms of how you, you know, you continue with your career, and there's no real rights or wrongs. It's what works for you. But that part of the business has become it's become an animal unto itself.
Everything is instantly reviewed now, right? And everybody's a critic, because on Twitter, people walk out of a film and
you got it, or I mean, who would have thought that Comic-Con, which is started out as like, you know, some nerdy guys and girls who would read comic books, and has become the standard by which a lot of studios judge whether their tentpole films, usually action movies or movies that have a science fiction kind of bent to them. That group, which is now has
huge.
Exploded, yeah, huge, has decides how much marketing is going to get put into a particular movie. Yeah.
There's another. There are other activities that you're involved in, like the work with the foundation and BEAT and things like that. The sort of citizen artist, civic engagement kind of work. What drew you to that? And why is it important to
well,
you?
Well, basically, that all goes back to Mom kind of like instilling that in us. That I don't mean that in an abusive kind of way. But we didn't call it abuse back then. It was my mother comes from a very religious background, and I was telling Carol, when I leave here, I'm going to do the 100th anniversary for her particular church. You know, that's part of the things that I have to do when I'm in New York. But it's all about giving back.
Yes.
You know, if you have blessings in your life, whatever blessings you have, and for me, as a young person looking at her, I could never understand how we didn't have a lot of money, but she would always wind up saving whatever excess there was so that she could put in, you know, so she can give back to the church. But it's about giving back, finding ways to give back. And that was ingrained, and so therefore, you know, I kind of, that's the way I roll. I have to kind of look over my shoulder and think about the next part of the wave that's coming in, and how can I be of help. And so that's where my work with the foundation that I'm involved with in Washington comes from. It's just about targeting something that resonates in me, and that's continuing education and trying to help young people get a leg up. And most of the stuff that I do is educationally oriented, and I think that all goes to the fact that it has proven for me to be in an industry where you can't quantitatively say, if you go to a graduate program, you're going to become a theater on Broadway, or you're going to become a movie star, or you're going to become a lead on a TV show. You can't really say that to a bunch of young people. But I know that this is what I've chosen to do with my life, and I will continue doing this in my life. And I think that the fact that I've had a well-rounded education has given me a kind of foundation and a springboard to be able to do, to be able to be versatile as an actor. So if that's what you want in your life in terms of a career, then I would say that the educational route is not a bad thing. And if that means going to a graduate program, if that means going to a particular arts program that's specialized, that might not be degree oriented, but something to broaden you in the chosen field, in your chosen field.
Do you have anything coming up professionally that we should know about?
Nope.
So. What kind, do you get concerned about that? Does one panic when one doesn't know where the next role is coming
from
still?
Sure.
Yeah.
Lost my mojo? What's up? this year, the work has been, it's been slim this year, but a lot of it has been by choice. And If anything, my Cornell experience in terms of like literature and my taste for the kind of work has spoiled me in a lot of ways, but that's a good thing. So you know, I'm out there looking at stuff constantly and having to audition. And
so, are there moments when you're offered something that comes into conflict with your artistic sensibilities and
all the time
training and
all the time.
And how hard is it to hold on to those principles?
You look at the bank account. And, no. I mean, one of the things that's interesting in literature and plays is that characters wind up trying to justify, you know, their existence on many kind of levels. For me, the bottom line is that the monetary aspect. If I don't feel challenged by a particular role, or the fact that I'm going to be working with a certain person, whether they be a director or a writer, or if I'm going to be working up on a particular piece. Those are the things that resonate with me in terms of how I make choices about mm-hmm. what I'm going to do next. So it hasn't done me wrong. But there, you know, of course there are times where you go, whoa.
You mentioned the director and the writer. Have you had different experiences on different projects with who was the most influential, and is the writing always first?
There's more control in the different mediums. Mm-hmm. There's the control quotient becomes a lot different, and so there are TV shows that are on right now, like Boardwalk Empire, or just the quality driven shows where the writing those particular production like that would have a harder time getting done as a movie. Mm-hmm. And they have a bigger canvas to kind of work on. So it allows the project to kind of breathe in a different kind of way. So the writer therefore becomes much more, it becomes a lot more writer driven. And I don't want to make a blanket statement, because for everything in our business that you say is a rule, there's somebody that breaks it. But for the most part, in film, a lot of the, sometimes the words can take second place to the visual mm-hmm. aspects of a particular piece.
Are there directions when you're working with a director that are not helpful? Are there things directors have said to you that you've either had to interpret, translate, or?
Yes, big time. And in the work in television and film, because of the visual aspect of the media, of the medium rather, you have people who don't have that kind of parlance that actors have and actors speak. They, because of their particular training or where they, if somebody started working in music videos and doesn't have any kind of like real knowledge of what an actor has to go through to create a role, there you get into these situations where just say faster.
Faster, louder, funnier.
And let me do the interpretation of what you mean by that. But the best directors to me, because actors need different, every actor needs a different kind of spark that helps to set them off. Some actors really need to discuss a certain moment or understand and because of that, they need to be able to verbalize that. There are other actors who too much talk doesn't work for them, and an image, if you give them an image, they can, transfer that into what the director wants. So the best directors that I've worked with in any of the mediums are able to look at not only actors, but different artists, whether they be the person who draws storyboards or their lighting person, they're able to kind of, they're psychologists also, and they can kind of pinpoint what a particular, their fellow artist needs to kind of spark them and inspire them. So the best directors that I've worked with have, whether it be theater or in television or film, have been those people that know when it's an image, a word will suffice to make that person blossom, to make that character blossom, or whether you have to talk about, why that person's mother or father, the character's mother or father, which has nothing to do with the scene, influences that particular moment, or seemingly has nothing to do with the scene. It's all related.
Questions for Jimmy? Can open this up now. Yes, please, back here.
I'd like to know, how did you study Archbishop Romero?
How did I study?
Archbishop Romero.
Archbishop Romero.
Oh, I didn't have to study Archbishop Romero because I didn't play that particular part. That was Raul Julia who did that in. It's funny that you would say that because I mentioned Raul in that context and he did a wonderful job in that particular production.
Other questions? Yes, please.
Hi, I'm a huge fan.
Thank you.
I'm surprised I haven't fainted. I love you in anything and
thank
everything.
You. Thank you.
I really, really like the character that you played in NYPD Blue. And I'm just wondering, how did you do that? How do you play a character like that as an actor? You know, this rough detective, and you have to be, and it seems so believable.
Right. Well, thank you. I appreciate you saying that. One of the dynamics that we didn't talk about, which is different from doing a play on stage, which is has a beginning, middle, and end, three acts, or a film, which, you know, ends, is that the canvas becomes a little bit wider on a television show. You get to kind of, you don't know everything about the character because the writers don't know everything about the character. Or you may have plotted a kind of background for yourself for a particular character. You might find out 2 years down the line that no, it's something. It's kind of a living organism, you know. So you have to be able to be open enough to be able to deal with that. But there's certain dynamics that apply that are similar, and in that particular circumstance with that show, all of the characters on that, I mean, you know, we talked about a kind of background, a schematic of a background, but all of those characters on that particular show had, they were, if the color palette was very kind of somber, and that's because all of them had some kind of baggage that the audience found out about through, you know, through the years, whether it was Sipowicz's character or, you know, Martinez's character or the Simone character. So that for me wound up relating, when I understood that, it was easy for me to talk to the costume designer about how he looked, what his wardrobe looked like, his color thing. It related to the way he moved. Where he came from, it started relating to the sounds that they made. That particular show, characters were always kind of like checking into each other, mm-hmm. and it was an editorial style thing, but it was something that was happening on the stage as well, and it had to do with the ensemble. So, I mean, that was and the Givens, which was. This here is a guy who is a law enforcement officer. And he's partnered up with a guy who's kind of like a bull in a china shop. So how do you wind up dealing with that and do what you have to do? So that's where all the little kind of pegs come in that you designate as part of that guy, Simone, and then you kind of latch on to those. And then be willing to kind of like, you know, David Milch would come down on stage one day and say, no, this is totally different today. And you have to be able to negotiate and deal with that, too.
So
but thank you for saying that.
About the character when you started?
No, no. Yeah. Well, I guess what I'm saying is that because it's television, the character is allowed to kind of like have a life that's much more than you would normally have in a play or in a film. I didn't know he was a pigeon lover. We didn't know he was a pigeon lover. Nobody knew he was a pigeon lover until one of the producers who happened to be a cop was into pigeons, and you know, but that became an expression of a whole other emotional life that related to his somberness or the things that were in his closet. So we wound up taking something that was very kind of extraneous and seemingly left field and applying it to that particular guy in a way that made the audience, I think, understand and attract themselves more.
Is there a relationship between the actor in a show like that and the writers, as there might be the director? In other words, are there writers who write for you or for an actor better than other writers? Do they take into account?
I didn't really understand that until I got on the other side and and you know, got on the producerial side, because there are, especially on a television show, there's a person who has a voice, but they can't do 22 shows, so there's a room of people and other writers. Mm-hmm. And ultimately, the creator of the show will have, depends on, every show is a little bit different, but certainly the work that I did on West Wing, there was Lawrence O'Donnell, who works with MSNBC now, was one of the writers when I was there, and he had a certain take on characters, and when his show would come up, the stuff that would come out of my mouth had a little bit more of a different kind of bite than when somebody like Eli Addy, who wrote for Gore and now worked on 24 and a bunch of other shows afterwards, his stuff was much more, he had much more of a liberal kind of flourish to his stuff, and you would have to kind of synthesize all of that.
Great. Other questions? Yes, please.
Yeah, I'm a big fan also of the Sloan character on NYPD Blue, but I'm curious, is there any character that you're particularly proud of, and why?
That I'm particularly proud of? Wow. I did a production of Man and Superman here, and I played Jack Tanner. I got to tell you, I'm particularly proud of that, because there was no way in hell, when I looked at all of the stuff that guy had to say, that character had to say, that I thought that I was going to be able to tackle that. And we wound up doing justice to it. I mean, there's, you know, different roles for different reasons. Again, talking about being lucky and blessed, I've gotten a chance to in television to work with some really wonderful people and really talented writers, and spoiled a lot again by the bar is very high in terms of what good writing is, and consequently the bullshit meter goes off a lot when I'm reading stuff that's not up to par. But you know, I'm happy with the stuff on Blue. I did a show a couple of years ago called Kane that I was really happy with. It was the most enjoyable thing that I did in a long time, and it was the most disappointing on a lot of levels, but it had to do with what was more about the business than what we were doing on the stage on a daily basis.
I enjoyed your work in La Familia.
Oh, thank you. Thank you. Thank you.
That was a wonderful.
Thanks very much.
Production.
That was a very special character for a lot of reasons. Thank you.
Yes, please, right here.
Thank you for being here. Do you have some certain routine that you do every day to keep that toolbox at the surface for yourself?
It's not an everyday thing, and it depends on what medium I'm working in. But we were talking about bioenergetics the other day, earlier today, and one of the people that was at the lunch with me asked if I still use that. And on a technical level, I can't say that I use what's in that book, but I understand, and I have consciously made a choice in certain projects or certain characters that a particular character center is in a different place, and that causes him to move in a different kind of way. And where that particular character, again, resonates from might be from a heady place or from a, you know, a kind of like a heart chakra, or, and it relates to choices that I make wind up becoming based on that. And that's just one very small part of the toolbox in terms of physicality. But yeah, when I get into trouble and when I'm stuck on a part, 9 times out of 10, I'll go back to acting 101. And what does the character, why am I having trouble memorizing this particular scene, or why or what? What does the character want in this particular scene? What is his objective, you know? What are the objectives that they're trying to reach? What's the obstacle right here in this particular scene? All of those basic things that you go, oh my God, we're doing exercise on that again, and it seems like forever. Those things, because they're kind of like ingrained, it, you know, when you take away all of the rest of the stuff, it's basically that, and it's basically what human existence is. We all want something, right? I'm here right now and I want something. I want to evoke something in you. You guys are here right now because you want whatever it is. You know, basically that's what it is. So, I mean, that has always helped to just go back to basics.
Yeah.
Toolbox.
Regina?
Coming from a stage background, what was it like gutting in front of the camera for the first time?
Very intimidating. That's why I like the fact that a lot of programs are kind of like augmenting their theater stuff with a kind of appreciation for what the cameras can do also. But it, you know what? Again, you go back to the one-on-one stuff. Because the bottom line is, it's all a bunch of terms that you can just, that you can learn and you can synthesize pretty quick. But it is, I mean, there is a difference. I'd be lying if I said that there wasn't a difference. There is a difference, and you have to get accustomed to having that other eye there and the stopping and starting and all of that. But it's just another skill set that you need to embrace as a friend, as opposed to thinking, oh, I don't understand what they're saying when they're putting a 50 millimeter lens in. It doesn't really make a difference, you know. You do what you need to do, and usually the camera picks it up. Now, it's better that you do understand when you have a different lens, if it's a closer lens, what that means in terms of, but you don't really need to know that, but it enhances your work a little bit more if you do know some of the technical stuff. But you're paid to be an actor, right? So do that as best you can, and that other stuff, that just like what I was talking about being a sponge, you'll, all that rest of this stuff will become your friend.
And I have a follow-up question. Sorry for that.
You have a follow-up.
So how receptive are crew and the director to you asking questions on set? So if somebody were to change the lens and you were to say, just curious, what does that mean? Will they look at you like, why did you even ask that question? Or will they be like, oh yeah, sure, this is what it means?
That's a good question. That's a great question.
No,
it's good. It's good.
Mm-hmm.
not that I don't have the answer for it, because I think time has become such, it becomes such a pressure cooker, especially in television, because you're moving so fast that you have to be able to, every situation is different. You got to be able to kind of like feel that out. Because no matter what people are doing, there's all, whether it's the guy who puts the lights up or there's a kind of artist thing that is happening there, you know. And they would want to kind of impart that knowledge, but sometimes it's not appropriate because of the time constraints. And you really have to feel the situation out and be diplomatic. You know, just be diplomatic. Does that make sense?
Yeah. That doesn't make sense.
Yeah.
I also really liked your Lackawanna Blues.
Oh, thank you.
It was a small role.
Thank you.
I really liked
Well, we all, that was a project that a lot of, everybody in that particular production worked on, because basically the director, George C. Wolfe, who's was the artistic director of the Public Theater, is a dear friend. He needed help. He needed people. He needed his peeps to show up, his tribe to kind of like show up. And I think all those people that were in there had touched George, or George had touched them on an artistic level in other things. So everybody kind of rallied and was there to show up for him when it was his time to direct. Thank you.
Yeah. Jorge?
Last time you were here, I asked you a question.
You were here the last time I was here?
You talked about Latino students and I was there. So, and I asked you a question.
So you heard the same thing twice then. So, yo, man, you said the same thing again.
About, you know, how you define yourself as a Latino actor or an actor who happens to be Latino. And the advice you gave me was not to get pigeonholed, which I appreciate. And I'm glad that you brought up
but. Sound like there's a but there. No, I'm sorry.
But, and I'm glad they brought up La Familia, because you said that was a personal thing for you. And I'm assuming that has touched you in a certain way to your Latinidad. And the playwright Jose Casas came this past semester. And,
uh-huh.
said, and I'm sure you're aware of some of the changes the department has undergone in the past year. And he said one of the greatest changes that he's seen is getting to see student work. And not only see student work, that by the end of the year, we'll see students of color have their work staged. And not just students of color, but also Latinos, plural. So, you know, in that sense, he reminded me that we're very lucky in that sense, and that we're very, very fortunate that we get to have that opportunity. But the thing is that other students of color on campus don't have necessarily the same opportunities. And I was wondering, what kind of advice do you have for them as somebody who is, you know, an artist of color who gone through the...
What do you mean that they don't have that opportunity?
They don't necessarily have the same support. And especially in other schools, maybe other places on campus and other fields and mediums, you know, the art isn't there.
Is that because the numbers are not, there's not sufficient numbers?
It's a lot to do with just funding, you know, a lot of the times.
Uh-huh.
And you know, what it means, you know, to do art in a big school like this.
Right.
You know, in an Ivy League institution. So I'm just wondering, like, what you would say to students of color who are looking to be artists on campus and who are looking to continue to do that art in the real world?
Well, first of all, education and an institution like this is an evolving place that changes. And, you know, you're testament to that. I think in concert with getting your education on a general level, I can only relate to you how it relates to me, right. Is that in concert with that, there's always this other dynamic that's going on in terms of how can my work impact my community at the same time. So I think that these other groups that you're talking about, if that becomes part of their mantra, that eventually the stuff rises to the top, the good stuff rises to the top. Does that make sense?
Yeah. I was just wondering, because, like, you have this experience that I think is really valuable that you can share with us, and that's why I appreciate you coming back on a regular basis.
And I will continue to come back, and every time I come back, there will be more of us here. You know, there'll be more faces. So that's what I mean about the institution being an ongoing thing that keeps on evolving and opening up.
Thank you.
Yeah,
yes,
thank you.
Right.
Yeah, my question is related also to the Latino culture. You have played the role of several Latino characters in the past. Other than the language, was it easier for you to prepare for that, or actually more difficult, or it was the same?
Well, my heritage is from Puerto Rico. My mother's from Puerto Rico. My father's from a Dutch colony in South America. But, I mean, I lived in Puerto Rico and went to school there for a while, so that's where I kind of live and breathe. But I'm trying to think. I don't think I've ever played a Puerto Rican character on film. I've played Cubans, Colombians, Mexicans, Chicano Americans. I might have played a Puerto Rican character, but I don't think so. But when I have to do a play by Nilo Cruz, which is about the Cuban American exile community in the 1920s in Tampa and being a lector and all that, the same research that I do when I have to do William Shakespeare's, I don't know, Measure for Measure, or Twelfth Night, or Much Ado About Nothing, is the same kind of research that I did for that particular role. Because I don't know everything. Just because I speak Spanish and, you know, I don't know everything about what it is to be Cuban and that, you know, I went to Tampa and I went to the library and I talked to people and I listened to tapes to try to make sure that the accent was right when, you know, the Spanish is a little bit different. Every cultural thing is, you know, if I'm playing somebody who's from Morelos in Mexico, he's going to sound a lot different than, you know, the guy from Ponce, Puerto Rico, where my family's from. So every role that I do, I try my best to give that as much weight and not just say, well, I speak Spanish and I'm Latino and therefore it's just a given.
Other questions? Yes, please, right here.
Is there a temptation in your line of work for people to become overly identified with being an actor and not having a life outside of that? You know, that their ego structure is caught up with the role and they just don't have much enrichment in addition to playing that part?
Much enrichment. I'm trying to understand the question is. Sorry, I'm not being dense, but what?
Right, I'm a psychotherapist.
Okay.
And sometimes it appears to me that there are actors who are talented but somewhat superficial as people, and that their identity is gained by the role, and when that role ends, there's an emptiness until they get the next role that they're playing. And I'm not in that field, so I'm just really observing.
I think there's a large part of people who are in this industry that maybe are quite successful that is applicable to. Yeah. Takes all colors to make a rainbow. I like to surround myself with people who are like architects or civil service workers or community workers, just to kind of like keep the palate fresh and I don't mind talking about the business and what I do with you guys, but it gets a little old to be constantly running through that with, yeah. So, I mean, I can understand what you're saying.
Thank you.
And I think it relates.
I think we've got time for one more question. Okay, right here, please.
I'm a big fan of The West Wing, and I thought that the job that show did a very good job of portraying, like, you know, real life in the White House and in the government. So I know that Matt Santos is a fictional character, but still based on, you know, based on a real presidential candidate, real president of the United States that, you know, runs for office every 4 years. So I'm wondering, with that, with a role like Matt Santos, like, how much did you feel you had to strike a balance between trying to be like real politician and being a real president versus putting your own artistic take on the role? And also, what was it like to play the president of the United States?
I was only the president of the United States for like 30 seconds on camera.
Yes, right.
And then out. Yeah. But that was part of the design. That was part of the design. But so your question is, what was it like to?
Well, so I felt that the show did a pretty good job of, like, you know, basically portraying a realistic view, you know, realistic idea of what life is like working in the government. So my understanding, there were some political consultants.
There were a lot of people that worked on that show. I mean, besides Sorkin's original conception of what he wanted to do with it, but there were a lot of people that passed through those doors that had intimate knowledge of what goes on in campaigns and with the political landscape that we know.
Right. So I guess my question is, like, do you feel you had to, like, struggle to find a balance between, like, all these political consultants saying, well, this is the way you should be a politician, this is the way politicians act, versus, you know, kind of saying, well, this is the way I want to play this character?
Yeah, well, it never got to a point where people were coming on set and telling us how to play certain things, but what they were always, I think that there was an environment that was created on the set where they augmented and were able to kind of like flush out what we were doing in every day in a particular scene. So to have somebody there when we were talking about why would a chief of staff want to strategize their principal in a certain way to get what they want, the principal being the president, or, you know, in this case, the president. So it was really cool to have somebody that happened to work in a presidential campaign and knew what that dynamic was. It just kind of like enhanced what we were doing. So it became your friend.
It's a piece of the research.
Piece of the research, but yeah. It was like right there.
I just want to wrap up with just one little. Jimmy and I were talking earlier about a performance we'd both seen in New York, and Jimmy talked about the joy of performance as an actor.
Bruce was talking about Mark Rylance. He's an actor, he's an English actor who's just an incredible artist. If you ever hear that name connected with a theater production, run to see it. Because he's an incredible actor. He did a play last year called Jerusalem, which he's won the Tony Award like twice already, right?
Right.
And what strikes me about him when I watch him is not that he's technically in control of his instrument and. What he does vocally, what he can do vocally to make you feel something on an emotional level is incredible. But there is a joy that he has, just a pure joy that he has in performing that goes above and beyond what you're talking about. It is the pure artistic joy of going into another skin and for 2 hours just having an audience become one with him. And when the curtain comes down and up, and I don't know if you watched the Tony Awards, but he's won the Tony like twice, and he never does an acceptance speech. He does like a poem or something like
yes.
that. But you'll see when it comes time for the bow that he is just like. And every time I see him, it inspires. It really still inspires me that there's a pure that in with all of the trappings and bullshit that happens with our business, that there's still that essence that of what an artist can do and how an artist can have an impact on people. So, for those of you who are and want to continue in this profession, just try to keep that artistic part of you pure.
Thank you so much. Great.